But the document itself is headed Laws and Regulations 1969 of the Regents. Well, this got out of date. Obviously, something had to be done about it. Now I'm sort of sorry I took the initiative, but I told the university committee, somebody's got to do something about these. I mean, this is way out of date. And as a matter of fact, central administration at one stage threw away all the remaining copies of this thing, so it was even not only out of date, but it was out of print. We had to do something. So my suggestion to the university committee was that I wouldn't do it without their authority, but what I would do is act as a kind of a reviser of statutes here and go through and edit this a little bit, change the word president to chancellor, and do some of those things that needed to be done, obviously, and organize it and drop out some paragraphs that no longer pertained, and so on, get up a new version so we can have something to publish. Well, they agreed, and then they thought, well, if we're making these changes, we ought to make some changes where the rules themselves ought to be changed, which was something different from my notion of the editorial approach. And so they kicked this thing around, this idea around some, and in 1973, this was Clara Penniman. I think this was probably in the spring of 1973. The university committee appointed a subcommittee to revise these regulations. A subcommittee, it turned out, that was to be headed by Clara Penniman. Clara is quite a strong-willed and determined gal, and she had been also a member of the committee, consisting mostly of regents and others, that had drafted the laws pertaining to merger, you see, in the role of the faculty. So Clara was very much interested in this and very much up on all the things that were going on. And so she was the chairman of this subcommittee. And I think I mentioned the other day that the regent rules, these 1969 laws and regulations, came from a number of different sources. The faculty, some of it was faculty legislation, some of it came from the administration. But all of it basically had been sort of worked out and then agreed to and then issued under the authority of the regents. And there would be no regulations in there that the administration had any reason to oppose. As a matter of fact, what would happen, the faculty would pass a piece of legislation, and if there was any serious opposition to it, that just went into a form of limbo. Nothing ever happened. You never heard of it again. If it was approved, and it was approved by the administration, and then approved by the regents and so on, then it would appear in the published thing. So really, it was a composite of all these. It was a form of government in which a number of people have their say before it gets published. Well, when you set out to revise this, it's never very clear where the authority of the faculty is, and in any case, you're thinking in terms of getting a final approval here of some kind, so the logical thing is to have some administration people on there. So I pushed this quite a bit, and I said this wasn't faculty legislation, it was university legislation, and we ought to make proposals by bringing these things together. Well, this was not a very... This was not very well received suggestion. Clara, I think, probably represented more than most people we've had the notion that it's the faculty's authority to do practically everything and keep all these other people out, you know, and so on. They did appoint some administrative members in a kind of a grudging way, I think grudging. One of them was Bob Borchers, the first time I'd ever run across him. He had been appointed, as a representative of the graduate school, although he was, of course, active in faculty matters. Dave Hansen was appointed, and Dave was a legal counsel lawyer, working very closely first as a special assistant to the chancellor, and then he worked up into a different kind of a title, but played quite an important role. Very good man, as far as I'm concerned, one of the most able ones. Naturally, we have lost him. A better job. And I was appointed. Well, we went to some of these meetings, and we had a lot of meetings, and what we started off with was a draft, and it was was very difficult to do anything in that committee. As a committee, Clara had some pretty pronounced ideas about how she wanted to do it. And I think the plain fact is that all of the administrative members quit coming. So this was really produced by this subcommittee headed by Clara, and I strongly suspect it was pretty close to, well, Clara and John Harriman together talked pretty much alike on some of these matters. Finally, this redraft came out, and it was a redraft that was entitled Faculty Rules and Regulations. And I said this brought up that question of what are these faculty or not? And it was definitely faculty in the sense that it came out of this. So the subcommittee headed by Clara then passed it on to this university committee headed by Clara, and then this went to the Senate. And the draft that was dated December 1973. And it was taken up in a number of Senate meetings. I don't really know how you can do this in an orderly fashion, because how in the world do 200 people write something? You know, I mean, this what you really do, I think, in a case like this is to bring a draft and hope that everybody agrees with the way you've done it and maybe make some helpful suggestions of where it should be clarified or something of the sort. But these were not... Well, it went through the Senate in a number of these meetings. Difficult to keep a record of, as a matter of fact, as a secretary, but it came out, and then we had a final vote in April 1974, in which the Senate approved this revised draft of what was then called Faculty Rules and Regulations. And that just sat. What I'm saying, we went through a long process to get a revision of these regulations, and then the thing was approved by the Senate, and it just sat. It was never reprinted. We had the original draft, then there'd been a number of amendments, and as far as I know, I'm the only person who ever had a complete copy of the original draft with all the amendments written in or marked in. My office, because every now and then in the next few years, why, people would come in and get a Xerox copy of my version, you see, to find out what this was. But it was never published, and it was never approved by anybody except the Senate. It came out of the Senate with the approval of the Senate. Now, at the time, Clara said in various ways, a lot of this is on tape, and it's kind of interesting to go back and see what people promised and said and so on. It's revealing in some ways. Clara said that this would not go into effect until it had been approved by the Regents. Well, this was consistent with some thinking of about 6 years before, but I don't know why in the world she said this, because I think she knew better. At least she'd been told better, told differently. The Regents had quit approving any faculty legislation. This was now the merged system, you see, and they got a big board, and they were flooded by things coming in from faculties from all kinds of places, so they just declared themselves out. And 2 years before, there was a document which I'd given Clara, which I mean was a Regent resolution saying that they were no longer going to approve any regulations, and they hadn't done it for the last 2 years and so on. And so, but Clara promised this thing, it would not go into effect until it was approved by the Regents. Well, my office had a lot of requests. People call in, want to know when we can get a copy, and we say, well, we don't know, because it's just sitting there and nothing's happened. And it just sat there. That new revision, as approved by the Senate, sat there for a year and a half, and nobody did anything. Nobody had any copies of it or anything like that. Well, at that time, then the University Committee appointed a new committee, which was headed by Ray Bowen, the former chairman of the University Committee, to go over the revised, what were then called the Faculty Rules and Regulations, and to get them into a draft that was then suitable for acting on. And they produced a new draft, and I have a copy of that. They were good enough to give me a copy of it, and it ran to more than 200 pages, which was about double the length of the other rules and regulations. So, and I never bothered, to be honest with you, frankly, I never bothered to compare the two to see what the changes were, because the Bowen draft then went to the University Committee, where it sat. And toward spring of last year, the University Committee then undertook to rewrite the Bowen draft and get it into a form, which they then, and they took a few chapters then to the Faculty Senate to be looked at. Now this is a redraft, the Bowen redraft of the revision of the rules and regulations. And the status at present, you see, they took these, they early came up to the university committee was a little slow in getting done, so what they did was chapter one, and took that to the Senate. And the first thing that you run into in chapter one is it refers to other chapters which nobody else had seen, you see. So so you couldn't really take any action. And what the Senate has been did last year was to revise, by a process of amending and voting in some cases, revise the draft that was to be proposed as a substitute for the previous draft. They didn't really take any action on anything, but they sat down and to revise this draft so that presumably now when it goes to the Senate way, then they'll sooner or later approve the whole works as redrafted and so on. Well, it's difficult to explain what the status of our rules are. We've got these regent rules which were never approved, never repealed. We had the 1973 draft that was approved by the Senate and nobody else. We have the Bowen Committee redraft that was never distributed to anybody except the University Committee, and now we have the University Committee 1977 draft, which they managed to get through about four chapters or five chapters of this string of them. And there's nothing in print, and it's very embarrassing in the office because people call in and quite logically want a copy of the regulations. And at times I have undertaken to try to explain this where we stand, but it doesn't make sense to anybody.
I can see why.
It does, and the other thing that's really difficult is the question of what are the rules. Ed Young said at one stage, "Well, what we do here is accept the Senate version of this thing if it suits us, and if it doesn't suit us, we won't." Because technically the regent rules are still in effect, although nobody would take that seriously because these are old and they have been outdated by history, among other things. But where beyond that you go for the rules, nobody knows. There are no laws in print. Now, I don't think that they did such a horrible job in revising this, in spite of a few things that I would disagree with strongly. Yeah, they did a pretty good job of revising it, except that they had, and this is the starting with the University Committee drafts, and I think maybe reflecting a tendency that's common through all society, they have a very great tendency to over-legislate by my standards. Where we used to have a few very kind of open-ended and loose rules, there's been a tendency to get these all down so that they're now in black and white and very specific. And quite commonly what happens is that you turn out a very complicated rule to explain something that in a general way we had before, but they got very specific and complicated. Then when you make a very complex rule, there's always something you have not anticipated, so that you cannot tolerate. So then you need another rule to take care of the previous rules and so on. So we've been going through that process. One of the major problems was that there came out of this a rule saying that a faculty member has to have a half-time appointment in the university in order to be a faculty member. I think that's worth talking about for a little bit.
That is interesting.
We never had such a rule before, and I think if anybody had asked us what the rule was, we'd say that, well, you appoint somebody as a professor, and he's a professor, and it doesn't make any difference whether he's half-time or not, and so on. This rule, and I think I'm quite, I think I'm sure of my facts here. This rule grew out of a deal between Clara Penniman and Serena Ponder. Serena was in the, she was very active in affirmative action in those days. This was in 1973. And what she was trying to do was to establish some kind of a situation in which women could go to work for the university on a part-time basis. And these were not people who, Serena's clients, in this case, I think were not people who would ordinarily be able to take on a regular full-time faculty appointment, but they wanted to act as a member of the faculty on some kind of a part-time arrangement. And the question is how you... Now, Clara was never very strong for anything like affirmative action. She was... tends to have some suspicions about women in the university anyway, I think. But anyway, they solved this between the two of us by setting some kind of a half-time rule here, saying that you have to be at least a half-time member of the faculty in order to be a member of the faculty, 50% or more. So that this took care of that particular problem. That's the only connection in which it came up. Well, this was presented, now let's see, that would have been presented in the spring of 1973, and it was a very interesting thing. If anybody wants to go back and listen to the tape of that, how that was presented, but this idea was kind of slipped in as part of a package on affirmative action and some other things. Well, so we had a rule saying that you had to have, a half-time appointment in the university in order to be a member of the faculty. Well, this surfaced later. When Clara then became chairman of the university committee, it surfaced later because it applied to people in extension. Now, you recall that when we got under merger, it was understood and written into the merger bill, I think, that extension is a separate university. I mean, in effect, they call them institutions and not university, but we've got university and then we've got some institutions and they're all separate. Extension is separate. Well, previously, and I'd grown up with it, in which extension was simply an arm of the university, and you might work for the extension on an extension program, or you might work some other kind of an appointment, but you're all part of the university.
Well, some people even did both.
Yeah. Well, this is quite common. But this was brought up, and I forgot what connection was brought up, by the university committee, and they pointed again in this favorite way of pointing again to the action of the Senate, which has never been discussed or considered by the Senate, as the rule, you see. This guy has got a more than a half-time extension appointment, so he's not a member of our faculty. Well, I remember at that stage, this question had never arisen before, and who thought it was going to come up? Never been discussed, never part of any... On the rule when it was passed. At this stage, I went down to see Ed Young, and I had a list. I said, I'm not sure this is complete. I did it in a hurry. But here's a list of 144 members of the College of Agriculture who have been disenfranchised by this new rule of the Senate. Ed looked at the list, and he said, oh, we can't stand this, you see. Well, I couldn't either, because this list included a lot of people who had been appointed at the same time I had, and they'd been appointed professors in the university, and it happened that they worked more than 50%. Some of them worked up to 100% on extension funds, but they're members of the faculty. They were always considered members of the faculty, and they acted as members of your departmental faculty and so on. I mean, they were indistinguishable except from the kind of tasks they took and their budget. I complained originally about this thing, this kind of rule, when it first surfaced, I said, look, when we make an appointment as a professor, why, we don't ask where his money comes from, because his money changes. You see, the current budget situation is really a matter of sort of fiscal expediency. And if here's a fellow who's been appointed as a professor, and then along comes an opportunity sometime later for him to go on some kind of a grant or some kind of a leave status and so on, where his budget situation, the allocation, comes from outside the university or something like that. Well, then his status changes. And I said, you can't have a member of the faculty who's 1 year a member of the faculty, and then next year he's not, and then the next year after that program is over with, why, he's back and all that sort of thing, jumping around. I've always maintained the idea that if you're a professor, you're a professor, and all professors are professors, and they all have about the same sort of rights. Well, anyway, this created a lot of problem, and as a matter of fact, this same darn problem has tended to bug us ever since. Now, the way to solve that problem is to get rid of what was an unwise rule to begin with, but that's not the way we've operated. We have the half-time rule. It has been, eventually, something was worked out with respect to extension, and basically what the university committee finally came up with was an obvious one. They said this didn't apply to extension appointments. and something of that sort. So now we're taken care of on that particular thing pretty well, as far as I'm concerned. And of course, what are you really worried about? The people you already appointed, and so on. So we sort of took care of the extension one, but the same rule has surfaced more recently in connection with the Retire and Teach program. I may have said something more about this, but several years ago, about 1975, somebody came up with a plan for the, it came up through the system office, a plan under which faculty members could legitimately retire and start to draw a retirement annuity through the state teacher's retirement system, and then continue to be employed part-time by the university and get part of a salary and draw the retirement annuity, which this would have a number of advantages. In the first place, to be blunt about it, it would solve some fiscal problems for the university, particularly in a university like Whitewater and some of these others that were bothered. This was a way of getting, cutting back on the salary that you were spending on some of your senior people so as to release money, maybe to buy new professors, maybe to just balance your books and so on. And so the individual himself can draw income from two sources and come out somewhere near what he was getting. Probably, well, this would be voluntary, but one that would suit his current needs, you see. Well, this is a pretty good program. It's pretty important, I think, from the viewpoint of the university. Now, the day before Ed Young left the office of the chancellor and became president, he signed a letter, which sounds entirely unlike anything Ed would ever write or even subscribe to if he acted the way I would assume. But he signed a letter about a particular case that is based on this half-time rule, and it absolutely knocks this retire and teach program into a cocked hat. The problem really is this: you can, under the state teacher's retirement law, draw an annuity as long as you are not employed. Well, as long as your principal employment is not as a teacher. I shouldn't get into technicalities, but we get by if somebody is hired for less than half time, because then their principal occupation is not as a teacher. So you can hire somebody, continue somebody at less than half time, and still be entitled to this retirement annuity. But under this half time rule, you have to be more than half time in order to be a member of the faculty. So you can't do it both ways. And I think it was a bum rule to begin with, and then I think it was a very unwise administrative interpretation. I kept arguing that, look, we can't, on the basis of this kind of a faculty rule with kind of obscure antecedents and doubtful validity and so on, throw out a program that has been announced and made available to all members of the system faculty. This is a right of the faculty, and you can't say it's impossible on this rule. Well, anyway, that's the half-time rule, and I think this one came from Serena, that letter, but it was a poor judgment, I think, on that letter. So I say, that was signed the day before Ed walked out of the office. Well, this lack of laws and regulations is a major problem for my office, because one of our common functions has been to answer a lot of questions. People call us on all kinds of things, and they want to know what the laws are, and we send them a copy, and so on. Well, it's bad enough to say, well, no, there aren't any copies we can distribute. We can sometimes Xerox a few pages for you and send them, but there's nothing in print, you see, because there's nothing that's been approved far enough to go ahead. It costs a lot of money, you see, to print up enough copies of this to go around with the faculty. So that's one of the problems, but more is a problem is the fact that I don't know what the rules are. And it's very embarrassing to have somebody ask you a rule about how you calculate the tenure period. Some rule that really ought to be definite, precisely known to all the people, since it involves rights and the obligations of the department. I mean, many of these rules, it's very embarrassing to say that you just don't know what the answer is. I have always been reluctant to go to the university committee. In the first place, the university committee would say that anything the Senate has approved is the rule that's enforced. Now, this kind of begs all these questions that we've raised about whether this is, whether it actually is enforced, or whether it's been approved, or whether we can accept it, or so on. They would say anything the Senate has approved is enforced, but quite frequently they say, but we're on the process of revising it, so where are your rules? It's a real mess. But perhaps enough on that. This is kind of a sorry state that I think some of the faculty affairs have got into. This is that particular thing, the lack of rules, has been a problem for my office, the secretary of the faculty office, but probably worse from our viewpoint is that the university committee, particularly now, makes practically no use of the secretary of the faculty. For all practical purposes, they operate independently of the secretary of the faculty. For the past year, we have not done much but take the things that the university committee has written up and handed us and reproduce them in quality and send them around. We never get any chance to begin with, I mean, at some earlier stage even to get in editorial changes that ought to be in, you know, like these things like, I have made some at the last minute without telling anybody, like changing Senate to faculty and a few of those things, but we've never had any input. In fact, this last year there were times when I didn't even know whether we were going to have a Senate meeting. I mean, this was something that was locked up in the university committee, and people would call and say, is there going to be a Senate meeting next Monday? And I would say, I don't know. And this is no position for the secretary of the faculty to be in.
Wanna why this happened?
Well, Donna, I say these things kind of go by small increments, small changes over a period of time. The current university committee doesn't know really that it is departing from a tradition of, say, 4 or 5 years ago, so they're not really aware of it. I don't think it's deliberate. I expect there's a tendency for a move in a certain direction to perpetuate itself. Aside from the obvious tendency of faculty now to have nothing to do with administration, which I may be the main cause for this. I mean, why should the university committee talk to an administrator, you see, about these things? They go to me for the typing services, that's what they do. But I say this self-perpetuating thing, if as secretary of the faculty with some feeling that at least I've been involved in this and I know something about it and my gosh, somebody ought to listen to me and so on, if I'm sort of excluded from any of these actions until they show up, I only come up in a negative way. I mean, we want to tell them after the fact that no, I'm not going to abide by that. You can do anything you want to, but I'm going to do it some other way and so on. Well, this isn't the way to endear yourself. So I think there's some personalities in this. I used to fight very good with Clara Penniman on a lot of things she did. I thought that what she did in many cases was never proved to be quite as much of a disaster as I thought it would be, but I mean, some of these things were very bad, and I'd argue with her, and she would then go ahead and do her own way, and by gosh, she wouldn't tell me the next time. So I think it was about the Clara Penniman period in which I began to move away from this. Incidentally, this was kind of an interesting thing. Now, a lot of other people did not agree with what Clara was doing either. And something would come up in which, in case I would come head on and Clara, I recall some meetings with the university committee in which the university committee was acting doing their best to kind of smooth things over between Clara and me, because we were, I suppose we were both getting red in the face, you know, and just kind of getting speechless because we were just banging head on, confronting. Well, in those cases, some of them, I would go down, I'd say, look, Ed, go down to the chancellor and say, talk to the chancellor and say, look, this is what the university committee is doing. And I said, I have done what I could to talk Clara out of this sort of thing, and we got into this sort of, I recall one, I did one occasion, but this, I'm sure something of this sort happened more than once, but I recall one occasion when he turned to his secretary and said, Jerry, call Clara and ask her if she wants to come out to the house, out to Brittingham, you know, for cocktails tonight. So, I would try the hard guy approach on Clara in direct confrontation, and Ed would do the old soft soap job. He'd have Clara out to his house, and he'd feed her drinks, and then she'd go ahead and do just exactly what she wanted to do anyway. And we've laughed about it since. I said, we've tried two ways, and neither one of them work, and so on. Well, maybe this kind of leads into what's happened to the office of the Secretary of the Faculty. I quit this job in March. This was before there was any word about Ed Young being president. I went in to see Ed. I didn't really go in to quit. What I went in, though, was to tell him how things were going and saying it can't go this way. And the only way you can do this, take that kind of a position, is to be prepared to quit, you know. I mean, you... anyway, we had talks of this sort for over a period of several months, and then in March I quit on the grounds that the job had sort of vanished, and Ed never Ed accepted this. I knew he wasn't going to tell anybody that I'd quit or anything like that, so I came out of his office and went down and promptly told my girls and people who worked for me, and I told some of my friends. I did not issue any published statement or anything like that, but I quit, and then I went on a vacation in early March.
Did you write a letter of resignation?
No, I don't think so. No, let me say it differently. I wrote letters, copies of which I gave the university committee, which basically said these are the problems, and I'm in a very awkward position if people go ahead and do things that I'm supposed to be doing. And so I, in a way, my letters stated the situation, and no, I didn't write a letter of resignation, and it wouldn't be the kind to answer it anyway if I had. So, I mean, I quit, and I told everybody, and this was understood as far as I was concerned. The university committee has never said anything to me about this, which always strikes me kind of odd. I mean, I say the university committee pulled, almost quit having anything to do with the office of the secretary of the faculty, for whatever reasons we don't know. But it has always seemed to me that the university committee ought to have an interest in what happens to an office that is really supposed to be the one faculty office in the whole administration. Never said a word to me about why I quit, or what the office needed, or any discussed any of the problems about the office, let alone my own personal ones here.
Although you had written a letter to them stating what your difficulties
were. Oh, they knew I'd quit. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this has been going on. So we're talking about March to March to August. Nobody in the university committee has ever raised this question, why I quit or anything about it. Now, I quit really because the office had petered out. Earlier, I think I told you that the formal functions of the secretary of the faculty are relatively few. They're the kinds of things that you have to be around all the time for keeping the records, writing the minutes and so on. I think I mentioned that earlier one time. Mm-hmm. They don't amount to much. Now, what keeps the office going are the other things that you get attached to this office. One of them, one of the big area, this are things you get from the faculty side. And then another big area are things you get from the administrative side, administrative functions and so on that are attached to that office. And you put all these together and you can have a big, interesting, exciting sort of a thing going. On the whole, you can do without the faculty part, or you can do without the administrative part, but you can't do without both of them. I guess I lost both of them. I'd say I got very little from the faculty side, very little support or involvement from the faculty side. That is, being sort of isolated from the university committee. Now, this was a great disappointment to Ed Young as well as to me, because when I took the office to begin with, I think we both agreed on the idea that there should be what is basically kind of an executive arm or an executive office or something attached to the university committee, some permanent administrative office that would provide some kinds of this backup for the university committee, so that we keep the files and we do a lot of things working as not as a member but along pretty close together with the university committee in conducting these things. And that just vanished over the years.
But it could have provided something of the continuity that you say was lacking.
Sure. I think that's the main argument. They don't have this continuity. The only continuity they have is in their secretaries, and they've never been particularly good at keeping them very long. They have files, and I guess I assume that they're like I am when it comes to these files. You're confronted with four big file cabinets full of documents. You turn someplace else, you don't search this out to find out, to dig up the historical things. Well, as a matter of fact, we had some ideas at one time, or I did the ideas. I was thinking, here comes up a matter of policy, comes before the university committee, becomes obvious that somebody has to give some thought to this, and the logical thing is for somebody to do some kind of staff work on that and bring together all the documents and all the historical background so that you know what you're doing there. And that's something that I think can only be done by something like the Office of the Secretary of the Faculty.
Unless, sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, well... Anyway, they pulled out, and they've never asked, and I would say that their support for the Office of the Secretary of the Faculty has been practically zero. One of the other, from the faculty side, involvements we've had has been as the kind of the administrative home of the Divisional Executive Committees. We have these four divisional executive committees, and we have provided, actually since I became, I mentioned this the other day, since I became secretary, we have provided a coordinator and an office. And so this has been attached to us in an administrative way, but not in any functional way. That is, they operate pretty much independently. I've been more concerned since I quit the job. I've been more concerned about keeping something a viable, growing concern there, something that can at least continue to exist on a reduced scale, but continue independently. The Divisional Executive Committees this spring wrote a very remarkable letter to the Chancellor saying that they wanted to be attached to the Office of the Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs. I immediately looked up my friends as a chairman and says and asked them what's going on here. I mean, since they were attached to the secretary of the faculty, why they wanted to be attached to him? To Borchers, really. Well, they said it's our understanding the office of the secretary of the faculty is disintegrating and we're going to be up for grabs, and we want to be attached to Borchers and we don't want to be attached to Serena Ponder.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was a letter that was about as it was not direct in the sense that they mentioned by name or as bluntly as I put it, but it was about the most obvious thing that you ever heard. I mean, they had all the arguments why they should not be attached to some kind of an office that was that has been headed by Serena Ponder. Well, we've got after that a little bit, and more recently they wrote a kind of an amended one. You see, that's the kind of thing, if they had pulled out, and that's the kind of thing that would continue to dissolve what's left of the Office of the Secretary of the Faculty. They've written a more amended one and said they want to be attached to the Office of the Secretary of the Faculty, so for whatever that means. But that is not very much, that is kind of an administrative thing, and it doesn't really occupy the Secretary very much because... the divisional committees don't report to the secretary, they report to the chancellor, and they report to academic affairs, and they report to deans and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
We're always just a home, and that helps to build up the budget, but it doesn't really do much in the functions. Well, now we come to the administrative side. I said you can do without the faculty if they insist, but you can't do without both the faculty and the administrative things. And those have been pulled away too. And those peeled off from me beginning about a year ago.
No, I'd like to come to that.
Well, historically, what happened about a year ago was something very odd. And I guess I could see, I at the time saw what I thought was some handwriting. But I've done that all along the line. I guess one of the things that seemed to represent the end of my office as far as I was concerned, was at a Senate meeting last year, and this was on the faculty side. Steve Chafee, the new chairman of the university committee, got up for the first meeting of the year, and he identified and introduced every member of the university committee and said to the Senate, well, now, if you have any business to bring before the Senate, why, you be sure and see one of us. And now that was something the secretary of the faculty always did. Now, Steve was unaware that he might also said, take it at least, you can at least take it to the secretary of the faculty, because that's the normal way to do it. That meant something to me. Well, another thing that meant something to me was a year ago. This was in the spring. There was a vacancy in the office of the vice chancellor for academic affairs. Bob Bach was acting, but they were appointing somebody new. And it was quite a little while in which there was a search and screen operation and things going on. And then somebody would say, well, I understand it's going to be Bob Borchers. And indeed, I began to see Bob around in the hall there. He was sitting down, he was in the office there, in the vice chancellor's office. And people like Peter Bunn would say, telling me, well, Bob's here and he's learning the job and so on, so he's going to be the vice chancellor for academic affairs. But his appointment, after what was obviously a selection and so on, was never announced for a matter of, I suppose, a couple of months. And everybody expected them, the regents, whenever the regents have a meeting, expect to appoint him. Never showed up. When it was announced, they appointed two people. They appointed, Ed Young appointed Bob Borchers as the Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs, appointed Serena Pondham as Vice Chancellor for Personnel and Institutional Analysis. This was not a search and screen operation, as you perhaps recall from all the recent talk in the newspapers and so on, but they appointed as a param. And at that stage, it seemed quite obvious to, I probably should say, it seemed obvious to me that the decision to appoint Bob Borchers was made, and you take some action. And then at that stage, there was some discussion behind the scenes, and it then appointed Serena Pondham as kind of a match pair here. And then we speculated on how this was going to affect our operations, and there was kind of a general agreement that since personnel and institutional analysis, which means records, personnel and records are involved in everything, why, that office cuts across all the other offices you have around. And as time went on, it became quite obvious that Serena was enlarging her sphere of interest. One of the letters I wrote to the chancellor was all of them after the fact, because what Serena has done is pretty much decide what she wants to do and go ahead and does it. Then she has. Then there's a system in being. You see, an alternative system in being that becomes it. This involved our operation quite a bit, because one case, it was announced that she was the one who was making the decisions about who was to use university facilities. Now, this was by legislation and by.
I got after this one because it was a bum choice. This was one in which we sent some information around to the faculty, and it was turned out to be a mistake that caused a lot of
of trouble than I used. So I pointed out to Ed that I'd never heard anything about this, and if I had, I would have done it better, you see, that sort of thing. But this was something Serena did, unilaterally. Documents in connection with the Profs organization, documents went out to a mailing list that came from Serena's mailing list and not from mine. See, historically we have been the people who kept the directory. The directory really being the source of information, the directory information, from which we print up a printed directory, from which we make up mailing labels or addressograph plates or something for mailing things around, for which we make up microfiche copies of the directory that the telephone operators have and so on. But that record, basically the directory office, has been in the office of the Secretary of the Faculty. First thing I knew, something came around and did not come out of our office, I mean through our directory service. This was a separate system that was set up by using payroll data and set up by Serena and under her operation. Well, I'd mentioned these things to Ed, and more particularly as time went on, what they did was, and this was not illogical, what they did was peel off all the records function and Serena took it over. And at that stage I talked to the chancellor and said, he said, well, what does this do to your office? And I said, well, it takes about half my people, and it takes at least half of the salary budget. It involves about three-fourths of the office space that we have, and takes all of our records. That's what it does to our office. And the full implications of this have never been faced up to. I have some people in the office right now who are trying to continue doing what they have before, but the whole point of their program, the records operation, is over with. I mean, I've got people down there for whom I don't have a job. And morale is very bad, naturally. And I don't know what to do, but no real decision has been made on that. The last time I talked to Ed about this, I said, look, we simply don't have enough of a function left. I mean, these things have all happened, and you can't reverse them. And we don't have enough function left for you to justify keeping me. And I was, I get a good salary, and we have me, and we have Doug Dale, who's an assistant secretary, and we have a staff. And I said, there's not enough job here to justify keeping us. So I got out. I mean, I could only see that this meant that I had to leave the job. I did not do it really willingly, but there wasn't any job left, you see. And Ed never said anything about it. I mean, he never said, yes, that does mean you have to leave. I didn't give him a letter, but I told him I was going to quit. And he didn't say, no, you shouldn't quit. You should you should stay. And he never said a word to me about changing these functions. The things just happened.
But with his seeming approval.
Sure. He never said, but he never at any stage came to me and said, well, I'm kind of sorry, but what we're going to do is change these functions from your office to another one. So these changes just took place. And after they took place, what do you do? Nobody asked me about it. I would have liked to have been involved in this, in part because I think I know more than anybody else what some of the implications are, such as leaving five people stranded in my office without any jobs, you see, and some of those things. But this was never discussed. It just took place. This is that kind of a loose administrative approach that Ed Young has always followed. I hadn't talked to him, as a matter of fact, since a month or so before I left the office. I hadn't heard from him. So it's not exactly been a state of full communication on that.
Well, what happens next? Do we have another secretary of the faculty?
Well, Ed Young said he wasn't going to appoint another one. What we did was, what happens, I did it. The way our administration has been operating, I said, if I were you, I would appoint Doug as acting secretary, and then I'd never appoint anybody else. And he said, oh, I'm never going to appoint anybody else. Well, nothing happened much until Lynn Van Ness came around and said, what are we supposed to do about the budget? How do we change these? I said, well, I'm off as secretary of the faculty, so that was taken care of. He said, how about Doug? And I said, well, let's put him in his acting. And so Lynn Van Ness and I put him in his acting, but there's no announcement made on this sort of thing. No, I don't think there can be a secretary of the faculty. Now, I would say that this all depends on the next chancellor that comes in, but as of this point, even though I'm not particularly anxious, have not been particularly anxious to leave the job, I don't think there's any job left, you see. So I don't think you could have a full-fledged office, a full-fledged position, the kind that I thought I had or had for a while, without some changes in the administrative structure, at least. I mean, you've got to restore to that office some administrative responsibilities or functions or role or something to justify keeping this thing. So I don't really see how you could beef up that office enough to restore it to anything like it was before. Now, the new chancellor will undoubtedly ask himself whether he should have an office of the secretary of the faculty, and chances are the answer is going to come back to him that he should. Because this has been a kind of a unique thing. It's been an office. It was, sure, it was an administrative one, but it was not in the direct line of administrative responsibilities or something like that. And it was a very convenient place to attach some things that you don't really want to put in any kind of a administrative hierarchy. Well, the divisional committees. Now, the divisional committees don't want to have to report to an administrator. They want to, aside from their regular business, they don't want to be dominated by somebody who would. They want this kind of independence. And the logical thing, you attach that to the office of the secretary of the faculty, because the work with the university committee and all this kind of stuff ought to be attached to somebody separate from the administrative structure, because we rewrote our legislation to take the administrators out of this sort of thing. So it's a very handy thing in a political sense to have something that will continue on a sufficient scale so that you can keep it as a separate item in the budget, you see. If you end up with two people or three people in that office, why, then you attach them to some other bigger office because you can't really operate on that scale. But you want something that will continue, and a new chancellor may look that over and decide that he's got to have a secretary of the faculty. I keep being told this by various people. Glenn Pound has said it, and others. But the new chancellor is then going to have to figure out something to make that office a viable one. I don't know whether at this stage you want to say something about it. You asked me one time what I thought of Ed Young, and I didn't handle that very well because I'm not really sure how I do think of him. Ed Young comes in two, he has two different faces, and the one that I've always known about Ed Young is a man who's really a delightful man, knowledgeable, quick, very, very smart, humorous, in a small group way. Ed Young functions best when he's with a small group of people that he knows pretty well, and then you can really get the flavor. A man who's made very good decisions, been a very strong chancellor in the sense that he never lost sight of the direction he wanted to move, and he kept going there. And I'd say just a top-flight man in almost every respect, one that I'm proud to have considered a friend of mine and enjoy that sort of thing. But in recent times, and I'd say the last year, since a year ago, this July 1st deadline, when things began to, a year ago this last July, some rather unaccountable things have happened. Namely, Serena Pondrum has been pretty much running the administration as far as anybody can tell. And this has left a great many people afloat. what it did to me, of course, was destroy my office. I mean, I don't have anything left after Serena has taken off what she wants out of it, and, which is the records. I mean, it ceased to be a viable operation at that stage. I don't understand this. Serena, the real phenomenon, the real newsworthy person, and so on, and for the last year or so, has been Serena Ponder. Remember, she came in as the head of the Affirmative Action Program. I can even recall one of the first meetings in which she met with the Chancellor's Administrative Council, talking about the Affirmative Action Program and what we needed to do. She's very good at this. I'd say that you meet a bunch of deans and tell them what they have to do on affirmative action, and they're all opposed to you. I mean, this was something that was alien to a lot of our ideas and to the way we'd been doing things and so on. And I don't think Ed Young was at all in favor of this sort of thing. So what he did was appoint an affirmative action director and throw her out here and let her sink or swim. And I think in the process he developed a good deal of respect for her. And I think she was really very good. I remember when she talked to these deans, and they really chewed her up pretty good. But she stuck to her guns and got together eventually an affirmative action program on this campus that is quite well known around the country. So she became a very well-known woman administrator in connection with affirmative action programs. And I think had a national reputation, and I think Ed kind of gradually came around to where he had a very great appreciation of her, and obviously she's very good at that job, because she's aggressive, and she does exactly what she thinks she ought to do, and she doesn't take no for an answer, and she, if it takes somebody to beat down the walls, why, she's a girl that can do it. Well, what happened was that the Chancellor, for reasons I don't really understand, became very close to Serena, and he quit talking to other people. And as far as I know, in the past year, in kind of an increasing extent, he was getting all of his information from her. And as far as I know, he never would ask me about things that I would be presumed to know about. He'd get them from her, and he would act on them, or rather he'd let her act, and there was never any much real documentation of what was going on. But what I recall saying here the other day, I was mad at Ed. Well, two of the things that happened in recent months, and I think they were very bad decisions, and I can't understand them, and so on. For all practical purposes, the office of the secretary was dismantled, and naturally I don't think that ought to happen. But the same thing has happened to the office of the Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs.
Uh-huh.
The extent to which she has taken over operations in that area, I can't really put an evaluation on that, but this was a handicap that Borchers worked under.
Now, does this explain his leaving?
Oh yes, sure. I think so. As he often said, he was taking a job as a vice chancellor, and he was also going to get the authority and responsibilities with it. He had the title here, but didn't have the other things. To an increasing extent, Ed Young was taking Serena's side without really telling anybody he was going to do it. This was just the way it operated. Well, now, he has a very high regard for her as an administrator, which I never understood, frankly, because I don't think Serena is a good administrator. She has never assembled a body of people who works with her that I think has any real strength. What she has, mostly, she works mainly with a couple of young girls, young women, who are very much like Serena. They're not faculty people, or no faculty background or anything. One of them is Charlotte Wood, who's taken over most of the things on the records and so on. And the other one, Judy Murphy, who came out of LNS. Well, they're both bright, aggressive, hardworking gals, and so on. But they're not very easy to live with. Serena doesn't have much of an administrative structure other than that, and I guess one of the things I would measure a person's ability by is whether they build up an organization of people who seem to work together and so on. I would say at any one stage, Serena has more people who are trying to get out of her office than they're trying to get into it, which is true right now, too. But she lets things pile up. What she's very good at doing is getting these responsibilities, but at one stage, eventually all of the personnel action forms went through Serena. Went through Serena, and I mean her as an individual. They were piled up on her desk. And after about, Borchers used to tell me 6 months, but after about 3 months, after an appointment had been made and nothing had been formally concluded on it, well, we began to get into all kinds of trouble, you see. The budget got out of kilter because the actions had not been concluded. So there was a big stack of PA forms sitting on Serena's desk. Not particularly good in that respect. Now, but anybody's administration can be, administrative talents can be criticized. I think what I would hold against Serena and what I find unaccountable in Ed Young is are some of her ideas about administration that seem to me wrong to begin with, but at least quite foreign to anything I would have ever imagined Ed Young to be mixed up in. She is a centralizer, and Ed is one of those who likes to let people do what they want to do. After she was appointed to her new vice chancellorship, we went out to lunch one day. I used to eat lunch quite regularly with Serena, quite often. And I brought up the subject, but I said, you know, Serena, in this job of yours, you really need somebody to act as your number two person, number two man, number two backup sort of thing. I guess I sort of discount both Judy and Charlotte Wood. Neither one of them are what I would think of are people that you'd consider major administrative talent, but maybe I'm wrong on that sort of thing. But you really need somebody who's going to act as the vice chancellor when you're out, you see, this kind of thing. And she talked to me about this quite a bit. As a matter of fact, I think she was even contemplating, since we'd been friendly, I think she was even contemplating making an offer to me along these lines. Do I want to be number two in her office, you see, or something like that? And, she withdrew, really. That offer was never made. But she said, yes, I sure do. You know, we need somebody in there. We need somebody, she talked about somebody from the faculty, somebody with clout, because there are things that need to be straightened out.
Okay.